I'm proud to have Paige come and share for us tonight. Help me welcome Paige.
Thank you, JR. I certainly appreciate the kind words. I was beginning to wonder who you were speaking about. But I hope I can always live up to our friendship and what AA has done for both of us. And I remember meeting you for the very first time, and over the years, always being close to you. If you drank, and I know you did, as much as you love fishing, you were one bad drinker. This man, J.R. Cox, loves to fish. And if you listen to his story, he loved to drink, too. Like so many of us. I'm on very thin ice and virgin territory here Zooming this meeting. We've been Zooming 2 or 3 months now. My wife has even spoken a couple times on Zoom. But this is my first time to actually be sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And I hope to get through it, and I pray I will. In fact, I was prayed over mightily tonight, as we do whenever we share. So we'll be okay. But I want to thank you, JR. I want to thank everybody that belongs to your group, the Willow Springs group, and that you're going to the effort and the trouble to Zoom in. I want to thank the King to Believe group that is also sharing. We got Carol and we got Jane. I saw Lawrence, and I hope there's a whole lot more that I don't see. But anyway, I'm glad all of you are here. I want to tell you a couple things before I get started. To the old timers on the screen, Robert and JR and some of the others, I spent yesterday morning 2 or 3 hours with Dave Cook, Dave C. We went over some business items. We went over some personal items. We went over some fun getting together things. Then I jumped in the car and I drove another hour to Sanford, and I spent the afternoon with Wallace B. down in Sanford. Number one, I feel about this big, you know, because of being around those giants in AA. One of them had 50 plus years and one had 64 years. So anyway, my sobriety birth date is March the 31st, 1989. And I'm completely amazed about that. The Highway Patrol is still pretty amazed about that. And almost everybody that knew anything about my drinking is awful glad that I surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got arrested by Alcoholics Anonymous, might be a better word. So anyway, I'm most proud tonight to talk about my home group, you know, where I came from and even why I'm able to be here tonight. I'm a member of the King to Believe group in Rocky Mount, and we're one group that meets twice a week. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays, and we're a big book study, Alcoholics Anonymous group. We studied the book from the very beginning all the way through the end. It takes us a little over 2 years to do that. We also study the traditions. We do one a month, and unbelievably, in 1 year, one calendar year, we get through those 12 traditions. Now, that should have been a laugh from somebody, you know, but alcoholics don't always do everything the way you think they would. So we study the traditions and the big book, and then we also we have open speaker meeting, and then we also have a history meeting when there is a fifth Tuesday of the month. We study history. So we're all about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that are given to us, right on down to the pamphlets. We're a three legacy group. We meet and we look for the newcomer. We fight over the newcomer sometimes. We're always on the lookout for them and welcome them. They're the lifeblood of our sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous and our home group. We wouldn't be alive today without new blood coming in. I'm a big fan of Israel, and what I do know about that is we got two big bodies of water over there. We got the Sea of Galilee at that one end, the Jordan River comes in, and at the other end, the Jordan River goes out, and it flows on through the country and gets down to the Dead Sea, which is right down there on the border. And it's got an inlet, but no outlet. And so it's dead. It comes in, and so it's just it's just dead. And so we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, we must pass this on. That's where it comes to us from our sponsors and from the men and women that were in AA before we got here, and that we must pass that on to the new people and right on to the old timers that hang around. So we constantly got to be vigilant about that and be willing to do that day or night and whatever. And the textbook in chapter 7, it talks about it may not always be easy. In fact, it says it may be hard work. You may get a phone call in the middle of the night. Nobody wants to get up in the middle of the night and go meet with a drunk. But we must do those kind of things. If not, somebody might die. And dying of alcoholism, we know, is not a pretty sight. Even suffering from it, we know, is awfully, awfully painful. And that most of us did suffer painfully from our alcoholism and our drinking. So anyway, I got this home group, and what's important about calling it home is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a home. I lived in a house. I didn't have a family that I thought loved me. Now, when I learned through my inventory and sponsorship, I learned that my family did not give up on me. They didn't quit loving me. They just didn't want me to be around. They planned their family events around my work schedule. When I was gone, they would have a get-together. They didn't want me. They were just tired of me showing up drinking or drunk and misbehaving and getting just causing trouble. So I didn't know that. I thought that, like, I blamed them for the trouble I was in. I blamed them for that personal relationship that I didn't have with them, that I missed, didn't know that. And I just thought they'd quit loving me, but they had not. And I'll go into all of that if I get a chance. So my home group is very important. And I'm preaching to the choir, I know, because all of you guys love your home group. I love your home group. I've spoken down there many times, and I feel a part of down there. I've always felt welcome, I felt loved, and many of you are close friends. Some of you even been in my home, and we go to multiple AA events together. We know each other's wives and family and children and parents, especially Robert's parents. I've served on a board with his mom at a Wilson halfway home. So in any case, we know his brother has finally made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're extremely happy about that. To get them boys off the street and into AA is a big deal. So in any case, my home groups are very important. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays, and we have one open speaker meeting, but that's the last Friday of the month, and we plan that out, and we invite mostly people from out of town, and we make a big deal out of celebrating one person's recovery, and we offer world class refreshments at that event. Now that's on hold, but we used to do that, and we hope that when this mess gets over with, we'll continue to do that, and maybe even improve some of the things we do. But right now, a lot of what we do, that carrying meetings to the prisons, carrying meetings to the treatment centers, and serving and having child care, that's all on hold. But let me tell you what's not on hold, not in your group, not in our group, and that's still to welcome the newcomer and be on the lookout for them and be open to them. Our group, by the grace of God, has a church that let us continue to meet in a little small part of it. It's a big old church, and that we have a use of a kitchen, we have the use of a nursery, and all of the and a sanctuary, and all of that's been restricted because of this pandemic. But we still have this small room. It's probably 250 square feet choir room, and it has a adjacent to it a half bath. So we meet face to face in there on Tuesdays and Fridays. And for 21 consecutive years, we've never missed a meeting because of rain or snow or sleet or lack of utilities and a virus. So we're blessed. And that's not anything that we did. that we were just given that gift and we were able to get in our car and go to the meeting. And since then, since we've been doing that, we've had two new men come in off the street. I don't mean they've been wandering around or something and waiting to join. I mean, they've come out of the deep, dark world of alcoholism, and they have joined our home group, and we've already got them in the book. They got the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. They got the little Living Sober book. They got some pamphlets, and they're trying to get sober. And just last Friday, Tuesday. We had a, and she's joining us now. We had a lady from Littleton join online. So we had two join face-to-face, and we've had our first Zoom member join. So that's wonderful. Anyway, that's my home group, the Kingdom League group, and I can't go anywhere that I don't talk about them. And it's partly because of that I'm sober today. The next part of that is sponsorship. And I've always had a sponsor. I didn't know you couldn't have one. In fact, my first sponsor told me, I'm going to be your sponsor. And so I've had a sponsor that drank on me, and I helped him get help himself. He later died from alcoholism, but he was my first sponsor. My second sponsor, the most dear man and humble man and loving man that could ever be, tried to sponsor my father. I'm going to tell you a little story about I wouldn't be alive today unless Alcoholics Anonymous and that man had sponsored my father. And I'm going to definitely share that with you. So in any case, that second sponsor, he died. I was one of his pallbearers. I spoke at his funeral and still in contact with his daughter and who is an alcoholic and still drinking, and his wife, who is a very old, frail woman today. But she's still a good, close friend. My main sponsor, who has sponsored me for 20-some years, and is my current sponsor, he fired me because I was a nonconformist, and when he would tell me something to do, I'd want to argue with him, and I would believe my way is the right way, and I'm going to do this. And he explained to me, he said, well, Paige, that's not what sponsorship is about, and, you know. And so after 20-some years, he said, this is it. So we broke the contract. And I went to another sponsor, and he's dying today. I love that man also. But I've come back to my original sponsor, Steve M., and I've been with him, more, 20-plus years, and we got a loving, caring relationship. Let me tell you two things I know. I know who God is today. I know who my Creator is. I know who is the source and power behind Alcoholics Anonymous. Lack of power is our dilemma, and that how do you find power? You find it, it's read tonight, it's found in the steps. We were given these steps to meet our Creator and meet the source of power to stay sober. And the other thing I know is he's my employer today. Somewhere in our textbook, it says that I've got to quit playing God and that I got to go to work for this new God and my Heavenly Father and work for Him. And if I do good, I'll be rewarded. I'll be taken care of. And all these years, a little over 31 years, I've been taken care of abundantly, prosperously, in all areas of my life, physically, mentally, emotionally, financially, spiritually, at best. So anyway, so I know who God is and who isn't, that being me. And then I know who the sponsor is. And I'm the sponsee. It's just like if you were renting somewhere, you'd be the lessee and you'd have a lessor. And you'd pay them and so forth. So anyway, combination of sponsorship and home group. And about a five-year period growing through that process, I found out who I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk about my sobriety. I'm going to talk about how I got it. For those of you that's got a book, and then for those that you ever want to look it up, there's a lot of ways to talk about this. I've been taught to talk about it like this. On page 29 of the textbook, I'm not going to read it to you. I'm just going to kind of let you know what I think about it. But it talks about that every man and woman describes in his own language and his own manner of speaking how he came to find and establish. That's a key word, establish. That means make it and put it together. Establish his relationship with God. And you know, that didn't say higher power, I didn't say this or that. And if anybody wants to do all that, you know, go at it and so forth. If I was gonna work with you and everything, I'd encourage you to think a little bit bigger than that and the creator of the universe and the heavenly father. Now I'm gonna talk about not having an earthly father that I cared for and about what that cost me in my life and so forth. But I've always had the Heavenly Father, even though I didn't know Him. But that's the reason that through life I'm here today. And so to kick that off, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. That is, my father was a bad a spade is a spade. My father was a bad drunk. We didn't know he was an alcoholic because we didn't know how to spell the word. We didn't know those kind of things. This was a long time ago, and we didn't know anything about that. We just know that my father would go off with the paycheck. That was important. And he wouldn't come home till it was gone. And even if he didn't have enough money, he'd steal some money if he wasn't ready to give up drinking. My father would go off sometimes for 2 and 3 weeks and sometimes a month or more. And then he would come home. Let me tell you what he came home with. I learned these words not in school or anything. I learned these words in Alcoholics Anonymous. He would come home restless, irritable, and discontent, full of shame, rage, and just disgusted with himself. But he didn't come home and beat himself. He couldn't look in the mirror and see this, his part of that. He's an alcoholic that hadn't been saved the way all of us have. We've been saved. We have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Well, my father didn't get that, and we didn't know about it either. But my father would come home and he would take that out on us. And he would come home and he'd beat my mom first because she'd be right in his face and she'd be trying to protect us, the family, 3 sisters and 1 brother. And then my father would just beat every one of us and then he would wreck the house. He might even just go in the corner of the room and pee or something, excuse me, and then he would pass out. Well, my little mom would get up and fix herself and go around the house and fix all of us. And clean up the house and clean up the mess, and she'd drag him off to the bedroom. Now, this family of 7, a mother and a father and 5 children, lived in a 2-bedroom house. My father lived in the back room, the bedroom. My mother slept on the couch, and all 5 of us children slept in the front room, is what we called it. The 3 girls slept in 1 bed, and my brother and myself slept in the other. And that's how we lived. And we didn't know any different. Well, what I just described is being kind of, it may be being poor. And golly, I hated being poor. And my definition of that, I don't try to compete with you, but in a way I do because I tell you about this every time I talk. My definition of poor is if you're a little boy and your mother gives you a bucket and tells you to walk next door and borrow a bucket of water, that's poor because your father has left town, took all the money, been gone for several weeks, hadn't paid the bills, and they're uncompromising, and if you don't pay your bills, they turn the power off. And that's what would happen to us time and time again, and there'd be no food in the house and so forth. Well, let me tie this in real quick. My father did get mixed up with AA. It never took on him and didn't stick, but he got into AA. And he got a sponsor, 2 of the kindest men. Well, I say 2 because they always came together. My father's sponsor and later my sponsor and his sponsor. And they were both old men then, and they were really old when they started sponsoring me. Well, on Saturday mornings, whether my father was in North Carolina or not, or if anybody even knew where he was, they would go shopping and they would bring brown paper bags to our mom and to our home, and they'd spend all morning with my mother. And in that paper bag would be always a little bag of coffee. My mother would make those two men some coffee, and she'd drink coffee with them. She loved them, and they would talk to her. Now, I don't know how many of y'all have been on 12-step calls. I don't know how many of y'all have worked with the families like that. Our textbook is full of stories about how they used to do things like that. Bill Wilson has actually had people to commit suicide in his home and die in his home, break into his home to get with him and things like that. Bill Wilson lived on the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous for several years. Him and Lois didn't unpack a suitcase for about 5 years. They would just travel from AA member to AA member after about a week and stay with them until things got better. So in any case, I reckon that's a reason in the textbook it says job or no job, wife or no wife, home or no home, you can get sober. And we know that you can get sober over any adversity, that Alcoholics Anonymous is more powerful than this malady that we have, this spiritual malady, this allergic reaction to beverage alcohol. And while we can't ingest it or while we can't drink it, we even thinking about it is bad for us. So we got to overcome that, and we can overcome it, but we have to overcome drinking two ways, mentally and physically. One, total abstinence. You gotta just quit altogether. And it doesn't help to think about the drink much. You can't do much about that. The sponsors will tell you, but you can take the right action. You can. We got two examples to get sober. The co-founders gave us two ways to get sober. The first one, Bill Wilson, he had that radical spiritual awakening, a puff of smoke upstairs in a hospital just before going to be committed. That's his fifth trip to that hospital. And then Dr. Bob took over 2 years. He's the one that's behind Chapter 7. He took over 2 years to get over the obsession to drink. And what won the day for him was intensive work. And that's a quote out of the book somewhere. Intensive work with another alcoholic. And he found out that would overcome the obsession to drink. So that are two ways that I know about. One of them is called the educational variety, and the other one is the puff of smoke. Now, I had a variation of both. Mostly, the puff of smoke got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the educational part of it was for about 5 years, my sponsors worked on me, and my home group beat on me. And so it was a kind of a combination. In any case, I need to talk about drinking for just a minute or two, and then we talk about how to get sober and how I got sober. So anyway, at age 13, for no reason, I'm the last man on earth that should have started drinking, because I never saw a pretty side of drinking. I never saw my father and mother have a little glass of wine and then slice the roast beef or something like that. Number one, we didn't have roast beef. and my mom never touched a glass of anything. But anyway, I never saw, you know, the TV, where we didn't have a TV either. I told you we were poor. But in any case, I never saw that. I just saw how mean my father got when he drank and how he hurt us. But when I was 13 years old, it was during the summertime. We were camping out in our backyard, myself and three other little boys. And we all were friends in that neighborhood. We belonged to a little club called a Women's Haters Club. Now, we didn't hate women. We didn't know women. We knew our mother and our grandmother and our sisters, and we loved them. But we were also being kind of introduced at about age 13 or so to girls in school and things like that, and we were scared to death of them. Well, let me talk about pornography for a minute. Today, it's a big deal and everything, but back then it was a magazine, and older men, we stole some magazine from older men. Now, I mean like 16 or 17, you know, we call them older men. They had magazines that you had to be a certain age to buy and everything. And they were just called dirty women, dirty magazines, but it's pornography. In any case, we had a stack of them. And I just dropped my watch. So anyway, we had a clubhouse, treehouse and everything, and we had those magazines up there. And we'd go up there and we'd look at them, and we'd say something as dumb as this: "I'm going to do that," or "I've done that." You know, we ran from them little girls. "We're not going to do anything. We hadn't done anything." They knew I was lying. I knew they were lying. Any case, we were in that backyard, and we got one of those older guys to go buy us a six-pack of beer. And it was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. I didn't know till a couple of years ago that they still made that. I was talking one night, and somebody said, "Oh, you mean PBL?" And I didn't know what he was talking about. Pabst Blue, a PBR or something like that. Pabst Blue Ribbon. It was just, you know, I didn't know that. But anyway, that's what we got. And we asked him to get us a pack of cigarettes, and he got us a pack of cigarettes. Now, we wanted a pack of Camels or something, a real man's cigarette. He got us something called a Kent. I don't even know if they make that anymore, but it was about that long and real thin, like a straw. And women would pull on it a little bit. Let me make this real quick and short. I drank most of the beer that night. I'd smoked most of those cigarettes that night. And I'll be very delicate about this. My wife is sitting here in the room with me, and but I had this first experience with one of those ladies, and it happened because of that Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. It didn't have anything to do with me. And what happened is, up to then, and I didn't know that, just like my father didn't know he was restless, irritable, and discontent and everything, I didn't know that I was afraid of everything. I thought I was fearless. And later on, all my life, I thought I've been fearless until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found I'm full of fear. And so, but that night, I'm an afraid little boy. I'm in hand-me-down clothes. We're dirt poor, and I get my first taste of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and you know, the book says that we drink essentially because of how it makes us feel, and it made me feel smart, made me feel good-looking, made me feel strong, and made me feel unafraid. But let me mostly tell you what it, and I didn't learn this until I got to AA. It made me feel like I had power. And for the next 30 years that I drank, I always was chasing that sense of power that I didn't have when I was not drinking, that power. And the book said that we have a lack of power. That's our dilemma, and that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our alcoholism. Well, I didn't know that, but that drinking took away my fear. It made me forget that I was poor. I had a speech impediment when I was a young boy, and I stuttered and couldn't speak plainly. I went to almost the high school before I even spoke to anybody other than my speech therapist. They made me get one of those back then, and I just sit there, and the teacher would look at me like I was crazy because I wouldn't say nothing. She said, "What, you know, what about this and what about that?" I'm not as mute as anything. I'm embarrassed. Anyway, at age 13, every bit of that went away, and I became a man that night. And I tell you something, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that we got something called some promises back at around step 9. Here's what I learned at age 13 with a six-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, that I intuitively knew that I would do this again. This was a summer night in the backyard camping out. I knew if it worked then and made me feel that like it did, I would do this as often as I could. And I set out, and I started living that way, even as a young boy. I became a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and a whore that night. My alcoholism, a lot of people think that it came on them slowly, and I understand that. I've worked with a lot of people, men and women, sponsored a lot. I've been on thousands of home group meetings, and I hear that. Mine came on that night. I became an alcoholic that night. I was waiting for it. In fact, it may have saved my life because I had a spiritual experience. If the definition in the textbook is true, that a radical change of how you think and act, it can be described as a spiritual experience. Well, one, the Heavenly Father produces that. Alcoholics Anonymous will push you toward that. And booze did that for me also, because I radically changed in my mind of how I thought and how I acted. And so I went on. I went on to about age 17, ran off and joined the Navy. I told you I became a liar and a cheat and everything. I lied to the U.S. Navy in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'd hitchhiked down there, and they asked me how old I was. I said I'm 18, and put my hand up and swore on the Holy Bible. Now, the Holy Bible didn't mean anything to me back then. If you knew me at all, you know that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous at age 42, not knowing the Lord's Prayer. I learned the Lord's Prayer in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And up to then, I had no use for it. Now, I didn't deny God. I'm not an atheist. I'm not agnostic. I just don't have any use for God. I thought I was a self-made man. I thought if a man worked hard, he could play hard. And that's what I did. I worked hard to get in the Navy. And I was just a young boy didn't know left from right, and there I am in the Navy, and I had a good career in the Navy. I'd no telling where I would have gone, because I loved it for one thing, and I had the aptitude for it. In the very beginning, I had all this anger and rage and everything that I was willing to take out on anybody and everybody if you point me in the right direction. And that makes for a model special forces type guy or something that has no conscience about hurting somebody or whatever. And that's the way I was. I skipped over the part where I had tried to stop my father from beating us and so forth. I tried to kill him. That story gets, I don't even like to go there. I worked very hard one summer to kill my father, and just about did. I forever changed his life and our family's life by what I did. I beat him almost to death with a baseball bat. Not proud of that. And I learned not about year 10 in Alcoholics Anonymous, over 10 years of going to meetings and everything, I learned that when God gave us those 10 commandments that's in the book, the big book, he didn't have a caveat. And I know that because most of my friends are either architects or lawyers, and they like to throw that word out. God didn't give us a caveat for the Ten Commandments. And one of them says, love their mother and father type thing. He didn't say if they were good people. He didn't say if they treated you good or nothing. He didn't put all that on it. I had a hard time getting the hate out of me toward my father and making amends to my father for my part of it. And everything, and I didn't get what I have today, a peace in my heart, and everything, until that happened. Now I'm not here to tell you that I love my father. What I am here to tell you is I don't hate my father. There's a difference, and so I've worked that out with myself, with God, and my sponsor, and to my point of view, it's put to bed. But in case, I found out early on that I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just knew that alcohol made all my decisions. My decision to get out of the United States Navy and out of a great career was my alcoholism. I'm on nuclear submarines by this time, and we go to sea for over 3 months at a time. But that is no home. That is no friendly place for an alcoholic, unless you're an alcoholic of my description. I'm a torpedoman by that time, and I worked on nuclear weapons and nuclear torpedoes on that submarine. And we cleaned the gyros with a fluid called grain alcohol, 180 proof. And the Navy had put some kind of chemical in it that turned it pink instead of brilliant, clear grain alcohol that you could buy at the liquor store tonight. So in any case, we were told Don't dare drink any of this. Don't get it on your hands and get it on your lips, because that pink stuff has made it poison. Well, you know what? I didn't believe it then, and I know for a fact it's not, because I drank 55 gallons of it over the years, I guess. You know, I found a way to live on nuclear submarines and stay about half tight the whole time. Everybody thought I was just the most well-suited guy to that kind of living in the whole wide world, and I'm just gone, is all. Now, anyway, I missed the bar life and the wild, uncontrollable drinking and everything. So I got out of the Navy and went on to the merchant service. I ended up in heavy construction. Then I figured out that what I lack is an education into the world type stuff. And I had a job where I'm a craftsman working, getting dirty in heavy construction. And I saw the architects. Well, those guys are walking around with clean hands and smiles on their faces, with nice white shirts and suit and ties. And what I like best is they're telling people what to do. You don't tell an architect what to do. You ask my wife that. You know, she has a hard time with that. The architects tell the construction people and everything what to do and everything. And that's power. And see, I'm always attracted to power. And up to then, I found power in drinking. So then I set out on that course of career to do that and get an education and do that. And I drank myself right on up. I ended up with a good corporation and a good business. And my company trusted me to do business in multiple states, gave me the use of airplanes and that kind of stuff. And the problem with that is I'm an alcoholic. And when I start drinking, I don't know what I'm going to do or where I'm going to go. And so I ended up going off on my last debacle. I took a company plane and I didn't come home with it. I'm a blackout drinker. And from the first drink, those first few Pabst Blue Ribbon beers, that night I shot out all the windows of a National Guard armory with a BB gun. That would have been a serious offense back then, and it would be awful today, I guess. I don't know what would happen. You know, they'd be sending the SWAT team for that little 13-year-old kid. But in any case, I always got in trouble with my drinking and almost always hurt people one way or the other and so forth. So my drinking was never really pretty, even though I couldn't see that. I thought it was everything. I had another wife 30 years ago, and she said, well, let's go to the beach. How long is it going to take to get there? And I said, well, that's the dumbest question I've ever heard. It takes about a fifth to get to the beach, you know. How long is it going to take to, let's cook chicken on the grill. How long is it going to take? Well, that takes about a pint. So everything in life evolved around drinking. And drinking also took everything. It took that marriage, it took that relationship with my son and with my family. I lost all that. And so I ended up just bankrupt in every area of my life. Physically, I go to the bathroom, I'm bleeding from both ends. I don't eat. I drink continuously, day and night. I don't know how I can explain that or anything. I sponsor some guys that never had a morning drink. And I've told them, I said, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, that morning drink has saved my life hundreds of mornings, you know, to get back to the bottle and start all over again. So in any case, enough about that. Let me talk about the steps and shut this thing down on time. When I was forced, I didn't come to AA on my own. I was forced to come to AA. My employer said, Paige, you're going to get some help, or we're going to send you to federal prison. And I said, well, how long are you going to give me to think about that? Well, they gave me 3 days. And that's the fool I was, you know, that I'm going to negotiate whether I'm going to get free help. At that time, that treatment center, I think it cost $40,000 that I went to. Or I'm going to federal prison for skyjacking. And I want time to think about it. What in the heck am I going to do? You know, this is a dilemma. And so they said, well, you're going to do one thing today. You're going to go talk to this man. I didn't know this man, but he was the CEO of a treatment center. He later become a good friend of mine. I helped bury him. I spoke at his funeral. But in any case, he was going to judge, and I know we don't do that in AA. He was a 17-year member of AA when he met with me on that Wednesday morning. And I sat with him for over 5 hours. I'm trying to tell you my whole story in 45 minutes. I'm not going to make it. But in any case, I listened to him for over 5 hours, and every time he'd ask me a question, he didn't ask me many, but when he would ask me a question, I'd have to lie to him. And so here's what I learned from that 5 hours. I left there not knowing you had to quit drinking to get sober. I left there not knowing all the steps at all, although he talked about them. I left there on step two, and the principle behind step two is hope, H-O-P-E. Well, I went there that morning hopeless. I was hopeless. I was a hopeless dying alcoholic. And I left there with hope. And I couldn't have spelled that. I didn't know that. I just felt different from what he had told me. I went home in those 3 days. I took all 3 days of that time. I had one more drink. As soon as I got home, somebody asked me what happened. I said, and they put a drink in front of me. Well, the same way I would jump back from a drink today, I went for that drink after sitting there for 5 hours hearing about how bad alcoholism is and can be. I went and I had that last drink that morning. But anyway, what happened after 3 days is that Friday morning I woke up and or got up, I came to or something, and I fell to the floor in my bedroom, and I couldn't get up. It was like I was an octopus, and I just spread out. I didn't have a bone or a muscle in my body, and I started crying. Now, what's so unusual about that? Well, one, I'm a strong physical man, and I can't get off the floor. Number two, I'm crying, and I hadn't cried since I was a little boy and seeing my mother get beat regularly and routinely. I'm not virtuous to any kind of pain or suffering that a man can have. I've seen some things that I don't even dare think about. I wake up, I'll wake up and we'll have to just go sit outside and to get it out of my mind sometimes with things I've seen and done. And I'm not proud of any of that, but I've had every reason in the world to cry regularly and routinely. And my father beat that out of me. My turn to get beat would come, he would say, "Boy, you want to cry, I'll give you something to cry about." And he would come down on you hard then. So I had quit crying. I didn't cry about anything. Well, I cried that morning, and I can tell you this, I'm not even proud of this either. I mean, I don't know how to feel about it, but I love to cry. Every now and then something will happen between me and my wife, and we'll share a story or we'll see something or a baby or a new birth or a beautiful flower or something that happened. If I see the flag go up, or if I see a veteran, if we talk about our country and our military, I just weep. And I'm not ashamed of that anymore. I'm not going to cry tonight for you or anything like that. But again, I think it's the one thing that kept me in slavery and in bondage to my alcoholism, in that I couldn't open up. And I kept all this junk locked up. And I've been able to share that through Fifth Steps and with my sponsor and with my home group and with AA and talk to my, trust my wife and talk to her with that intimate relationship that God gives a man and a woman. And so my life has changed. So that happened with that one talk to another alcoholic for 5 hours. I left there with hope. And then very soon I started being taught total abstinence and that about how unmanageable my life was. I used to come home on a company plane, get in a company car, come to my home, open the door, turn the light switch on, and the lights wouldn't come on. And I'm saying, what in the world is wrong with this damn house? Well, I hadn't paid the bill. The same thing that happened to us when we were kids and poor, the power company turned off the power. if you don't pay your bill, I guarantee you, you're going to be in the dark. You know, and that's what I'd come home and I'd go storming, you know, and I'm drinking and raising hell and calling Duke Power, and they're telling me, well, if you pay your bill, we'll send somebody out in about 3 days and turn it on. I'd go get a hotel room and stay drunk. Any case, that doesn't happen anymore. So I started learning the steps and taking the steps and being carried. I don't mean I walked through it or took to it. I was carried through the steps, and I was taught that when you take that third step, you don't have to take it but once if immediately you hear the sound of graphite on paper. When it says at once, we start an inventory. And then it says when you got that inventory done, I didn't get to lay around and everything. They said, we want this back here in about 2 weeks. And, you know, and that's what they meant and so forth. But in any case, let me tell you, I'm not perfect in AA. I'm going to tell you this right for sure. The only step I have not violated out of the 12 is step one. From that first date that I called the date of sobriety, March the 31st, 1989, I've not had any kind of alcohol in any form or any kind of mood-altering substance, whatever that may be, pills or tablets or drugs or whatever that may be. I'm almost a pure alcoholic. I had marijuana one time and went paranoid. The stoplight would be about 2 blocks or 3 blocks or a mile away, and I would start slowing down for it, and then I couldn't go anywhere without a gun. I just became paranoid, and so if my choice is between having a Pabst Blue Ribbon or some Jack Daniels, I'm going for that. I like the taste of it, and I like what it does for me. So I got a good friend in our home group. He says his drug story is about how his mother drug him to church, and that's kind of my drug story. I was drugged to church. Anyway. So my sponsors carried me through, and I tried to do this as good as I could, but it was over 5 years before I told the absolute truth in an inventory to one person. And I had taken inventory with or fifth steps with several people, but I could not get honest with God and myself and then share it with another person. The reason I couldn't is I was still not trustworthy myself. How can you trust somebody when you yourself are not trustworthy? And so that had to be a process for me. And so I don't want anybody to do that. I want you to put on all the armor of God as quick as you can, the helmet, the sword, the shield, the breastplate, everything. And that's what our 12 principles or our 12 steps are, is the armor against alcoholism. And so you're still at risk anywhere between number 1 and number 12. The book says that as a result of those first 11 steps, then you've had that spiritual experience. Then you're able to be establish that relationship with God, because you've had an experience with Him. He's become your employer. And that's what happened for me through the steps. I had some wonderful experiences with 8 and 9, especially 9, and making amends. I'm the same guy that took a chainsaw to a marriage, and the person wanted half of it, wanted half of everything we had. I said, yeah, I'll give you half with a chainsaw. And that's hard to overcome, but it did, and so forth. And Alcoholics Anonymous did that, not I, you know, through the steps and through sponsorship and the home groups. And so, character defects and shortcomings, that's 6 and 7. That's where my trouble was. And the two shortest paragraphs in the book, just about, I'm not a book technician, but the whole step is just two little paragraphs. Step 6, became willing to get rid of this junk. And step 7 is, and I give it to God, you know, type thing. I give it all to Him, the good and the bad. I had trouble with that, and my it took my sponsor to actually write out what he considered to be my character defects and shortcomings, and I had to own them. And he sent me to the dictionary to learn exactly what they were. And then he took me to another list to show the opposite. And of course, it's obvious if you the opposite of hate is love. If you steal, start giving. and things like that. But those basic things I had to be taught, and still struggle with it. Every now and then I get condescending. Every now and then I get judgmental. Every now and then I get arrogant. Every now and then I get short-tempered. Don't you know this? And why don't you do it my way? And that kind of thing. Gratefully, it's no longer my way or the highway. You know, I've learned that to make concessions. I've learned to ask forgiveness. I've learned to try to temper this tongue and guard the ear and mouth and watch my steps and stay on the path. And mostly, I stay a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have any special formula for staying sober other than continuing to go to my home group, continuing to be in touch with my sponsor, continuing to take a 12-step call, continuing to look for a newcomer, continue to study my Bible, continue to find a home church, continue to value and respect my wife and my fellow man. I know that before Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have a clue what the purpose of my life is. And we all can learn that we only have one job, and that's trust God and help others. I'm gonna close just about on time. JR, I think I went a little long, but I apologize. I thank everybody for being there, and I thank your group for having me, especially this wacko experience with Zoom, you know. So anyway, God bless you, and I love you. Bye-bye.